This afternoon we'll have a look at stanzas 8 to 11. Excuse me. So I'll just run through the first seven again just to hear the... It's not really poetry. John of the Cross wrote poetry, but it's in Spanish. So when you translate poetry, you end up with prose. But it's the best we can offer you. So in the first stanza, John talks, it's a cry from the heart, a heart that has experienced God's love but feels the distance and the absence of the one loved. Where have you hidden, beloved, and left me moaning? You fled like a stag after wounding me. I went out calling you, but you were gone. And then, under the name of shepherds, John talks about all those who've mediated God to him in his life. And he wants them, if they're in contact with God, which he or she doesn't feel, please tell God how lovesick she is. Shepherds, you that go up through the sheepfolds to the hills, if by chance you see him I love most, tell him that I sicken, suffer, and die. And then in the third verse, she resolves not to be attached to anything or to be afraid of anything, but to journey where she feels the longing to the one who's loved. Seeking my love, I will head for the mountains and the watersides. I will not gather flowers. I will not fear wild beasts. I will go beyond strong men and frontiers. And then in the fourth stanza, she asks creation if it's seen her beloved anywhere. Oh, woods and thickets, planted by the hand of my beloved. Oh, green meadow, coated bright with flowers. Tell me, has he passed you by? I'm reminded just now of Thérèse of Lisieux when she was taken on the one trip she had to the Mediterranean. Her father took her. She'd never seen the sea before, didn't ever see it again. But when she looked out of this beautiful sea and, excuse me, the sand and the seabirds and all that, she was absolutely stunned by it all. But then she said, if I don't see you, that's Jesus, then it's all one vast tomb. Kind of beautiful, but empty if he's not there, the one she longs for. In the fifth stanza, creation replies to her and says, yes, it has beauty and it's all from him. Pouring out a thousand graces, he passed these groves in haste, and having looked at them with his image alone, he clothed them in beauty. So all our beauty, creation is saying, does come from him, and he has passed through here. In the sixth stanza, she says she's not content with messengers. They're beautiful, she's grateful for them all, but no, she wants to see his face and hear his voice. Ah, she says, who has the power to heal me? Wholly surrender yourself. Don't send me any more messengers. They can't tell me what I have to hear. And then finally, as we saw this morning in stanza 7, all that creatures show and tell are mere stammerings. They increase her pain and her longing for the one who alone can satisfy her. Why, she says, since you wounded this heart, don't you heal it? Why, since you... All who are free, tell me a thousand graceful things of you. All wound me more and leave me dying of I do not know what behind their stammering. And so we come to the stanza number 8. How do you endure, O life, not living where you live? Talking to herself. And being brought near death by the arrows you receive from that which you conceive of your beloved. So her life is with him, but he's hidden. Her life is not here. How do you endure, O life, not living where you live, and being brought near death by the arrows you receive from that which you conceive of your beloved? John, in commenting, trying to explain that as best he can to people who asked for an explanation, writes, he quotes Romans chapter 8, "Wretched person that I am, who will rescue me from this body of death?" And of course, Paul goes on to say, Christ will. The soul lives through love, says John, in the object of her love. So she's living in Christ. But she can't see him. John refers to John the Evangelist in that which has come to being in him was life, and life was the light of all people. Jesus came that we may live and live to the full. So life is the sign, being alive. But her life is in him, and she can't experience full communion with him. So there's a kind of a dying, and she doesn't know how to survive it. John's comment on that stanza again: she doesn't possess her heart. She's given it to the beloved. Well, we all know what that is. And again, he goes on, she can know clearly whether or not she loves God purely. This is how she can know. If she loves God, her heart or her love will not be set on herself or her own satisfaction or gain. Brackets. Even the feeling of love or the feeling of peace or whatever. But her heart will be set upon pleasing God and giving God honor and glory. In the measure that she loves herself, that much less does she love God. Well, you have to play with that. It's quite subtle and there's a lot in it. It's the ego he's talking about, because if you actually love your real self, you are loving God. They're not going to be distinct. But if our love is for the self that presents and requires and demands and all that, then so much less does she love God, he says. And he goes on, the soul longs for nothing else but more love until the perfection of love is reached. The soul, says John, that loves God must not desire or hope for any other reward for her services than the perfect love of God. Failed to read stanza 9 to you, which was commented on there. And stanza 9 is, why, since you wounded this heart, why don't you heal it? Why, since you stole it from me, do you leave it so and fail to carry off what you've stolen? So Jesus has stolen her heart and taken it, but she can't see him. So she wants him to take everything. Stanza 10 reads, extinguish these miseries, since no one else can do so. May my eyes behold you, because you are their light, and I would open them to you alone. Now, I've spoken briefly about stanzas 8 and 9. We'll dwell on stanza 10 at much greater length. Extinguish these miseries. No one else can do so. And this is her longing. May my eyes behold you, because you are their light. I would open them to you alone. John writes, though she cannot help being occupied with other things, she always has her heart fixed on God. Her will, says John, is inclined immediately to seek and enjoy her beloved in everything that happens and in all her occupations, without looking for any satisfaction or concern of her own. He refers, John does, to Mary of Magdala and the suffering she had seeking her Lord, and it's an empty tomb. So I thought, in fact I only thought of it this afternoon, so this is hot off the press, that I would share with you a beautiful statement made by Pope Gregory the Great about the year 600 or something, on the feast of St. Mary of Magdala, July the, I think, 22nd, something like that. And this was the homily he preached, selected. But it's rather lovely, really, and it's quite modern. And he's talking about Mary of Magdala, and he says, look, because of the ardent love of her heart, Mary continued seeking him when she couldn't find him, even after the other disciples had gone away. Peter and John saw the empty tomb and were bewildered and went back home. In tears she kept searching, and afire with love she yearned for him. Thus it happened that she alone saw him. She'd already sought and found nothing, but she continued seeking and so found the object of her love. While she was seeking, her longing grew stronger and stronger until it was allayed in the embrace of him whom she was seeking. At first she didn't recognize him, but then Jesus said to her, Mary, as if to say, now recognize the one who recognizes you. And this wonderful ending to the prayer, outwardly, it was he who was the object of her search. But inwardly, it was he who was teaching her to search for him. So continuing with stanza 10, and repeating some of it, may my eyes behold you, says the lover, because you are their light and I would open them to you alone. John writes, possessing nothing that might withhold her from God, she can't remain long without a visit from her beloved. And John refers to Apocalypse 21:23, talking about the New Jerusalem. The city has no need of sun or moon to shine in it, for the glory of God is its light, and the Lamb is the lamp, the Lamb of God, the risen Christ. That's the light she's looking for. And he goes on, she wants to keep her eyes for him alone, longing to focus the eyes of her will upon the light of something outside of God. She's justly deprived of the divine light, insofar as the spiritual powers which she has for receiving God's light are occupied with the other light. So also, if she closes her eyes to all things in order to open them to God alone, she's ready to welcome the illumination of divine light. May my eyes behold you, because you are their light, and I would open them to you alone. I'd like now to take you on a little journey of discerning the presence of God in suffering, because John does that, so I'm following him in doing it with you. So we all have a bit of suffering somewhere, and some have a lot. Well, let's talk about suffering, whatever level it might be, and discerning where is God in this suffering. In his Dark Night, stanza 3, John writes, oh, that glad night! In secret, for no one saw me, nor did I look at anything with no other light or guide than the one that burned in my heart. There's a burning in her heart to find him whom her soul loves, and she doesn't need any other light. If, says John in the Ascent, we resolutely submit to carrying the cross, if we resolutely want to find and endure trial in all things for God, we will discover in all our trials great relief and comfort. John had a lot of trials, John of the Cross, as you may well know, his own order, because Teresa of Avila saw in him a possibility. She was reforming the nuns. You wouldn't think nuns would need reforming, but anyhow they did. So she's reforming the nuns, at least as she saw it, and she wanted someone to do it the same with the men. And she saw John of the Cross as the best one to do it. So she nurtured him, and then what did the men do? They came down and kidnapped him and carted him back to Toledo and shoved him in a monastery, a jail, a cell within the monastery. Kept him there for, and he got lashings, etc., and he was deprived of communion. He couldn't go to Mass. He was, you know, all that. They thought he was heretical to even suggest that they needed reforming. What do you think about that? So, at any rate, he was there, and you might know the end of the story, because the end of the story is quite, he was pally with the jailer. And because he was pally with everyone, so the jailer was sensitive to him, so he left the door unhooked one night, and John of the Cross jumped out of the window and landed on there was a big fall there, and down there were miles down there was a river, so whichever way you fell, he was dead. So he had to land on the parapet or something just between the two, and he landed on it all right. don't know why I'm telling you all this. But then where did he go? He went off to the convent. The nuns. They weren't allowed to let him in by law, but they let him in and hid him inside their cloister. So when the blokes came looking, they said, well, we haven't seen him. And he obviously is not with us because you can't do that. So apparently you can tell lies even for a good cause. Anyhow, the women were typical and they saved him and fed him up because he was... And then off. Well, that's one thing, but there were many, many other things that happened to the dear man, as happens to you and happens to me. So he knows what he's talking about here when he says he didn't look for any of these crosses, but when they came, he carried them. In the dark night, he writes, in the patience and forbearance practiced in these times of emptiness and dryness, and through perseverance in spiritual exercises without consolation or without satisfaction, a person practices the love of God, because there's nothing else in it. Love of God. Since she's no longer motivated by the attractive and savoury gratification which she finds in what she does, but only in God. She also practices the virtue of fortitude, courage. How amazing, says John, how pitiful it is that a person be so utterly weak and impure that the hand of God, though light and gentle, should feel so heavy and contrary. For the hand of God doesn't press down or weigh upon a person, it only touches her. And this mercifully, for God's aim is to grant favours, not to chastise. So John's puzzled and amazed by people who can't suffer anything. Any touch that's awkward, not realising that God is, whatever's happening, is in view of our purification. In the dark night, he quotes Lamentations chapter 3, which I'm now going to read for you. It's another inspiration I got this afternoon, or whatever it could be. The book of Lamentations is about five of them. Most of the Lamentations are about Jerusalem. They're written shortly after the fall, the destruction of Jerusalem in the 6th century BC. But this one isn't. This one is a later work, apparently, and it's a personal lamentation. It's quite stunning. It's powerful, but the bits are, I'll read it to you, a good bit of it, but it's immensely beautiful. So if you can bear with me while I go through all the heavy stuff, wait till the sunrise in it. So this is a lament. And sometimes you might be in such a terrible situation that it's good to read Lamentations chapter 3, because then you realise, oh, dude, what I'm going through is not nearly as bad as what other people have, and here it is. You ready? Because John alludes to it here. I am one who has seen affliction under the rod of God's wrath. He has driven and brought me into darkness without any light. Against me alone he turns his hand again and again all day long. He's made my flesh and my skin waste away and broken my bones. He's besieged and enveloped me with bitterness and tribulation. He's made me sit in darkness like the dead of long ago. He has walled me about so that I can't escape. He's put heavy chains on me. Though I call and cry for help, he shuts out my prayer. He's blocked my ways with hewn stones. He's made my paths crooked. He's a bear lying in wait for me, a lion in hiding. He led me off my way and tore me to pieces. He's made me desolate. He bent his bow and set me as a mark for his arrow. He shot into my vitals the arrows of his quiver. I've become the laughing stock of all my people, the object of their taunt songs all day long. He's filled me with bitterness and sated me with wormwood. He's made my teeth grind on gravel and made me cower in ashes. My soul is bereft of peace. I've forgotten what happiness is. So I say, gone is my glory and all that I hoped for from the Lord. The thought of my affliction and my homelessness is wormwood and gall. My soul continually thinks of it and is bowed down within me. But this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore, I will hope in him. The Lord is good to those who wait for him, to the soul that seeks him. So John quotes that passage and goes on in the dark night to state how we should be very gentle and compassionate towards anyone who's suffering in that way. And those of you who've suffered depression, some of you may well have, will know that the only thing that helps is love, gentle love. So if someone's depressed, you may not be able to help them, but the only thing you can offer is a gentle love, because that's the only healing thing for them. Again, in the dark night, John writes, "You walk securely in the darkness of the dark night, because you're advancing by suffering. Suffering is a surer and even more advantageous road than that of joy and action. First, in suffering, God gives us strength, whereas in our deeds and joys, we exercise our own weakness and our own imperfections. And second, in suffering, virtues are practiced and acquired, and we're purified, made wiser and more prudent." Later in the spiritual canticle on this topic of discerning where God is in a suffering, because this person is suffering through love, wanting, "The gate entering into the riches of God's wisdom is the cross," says John. "It's narrow and few desire to enter by it, though many desire the delights obtained from entering." I remember reading in the seminary 50-something years ago, I can't remember the book, but it was rather nice, and it said, yes, the way to God is narrow, but it's as wide as the arms of Jesus stretched out on the cross. So it's narrow, but it's an embracing way. In Living Flame, John writes, "It ought to be pointed out," having talked about the transforming union that we're all longing for, "it ought to be pointed out why there are so few who reach this high state of perfect union with God. It should be known," he says, "that the reason is not because God wishes that there only be a few so elevated. God would rather want all to be perfect. But he finds few who will endure so lofty and sublime a work. Since God tries them in little things and finds them so weak that they immediately flee from work, unwilling to be subject to the least discomfort and mortification, it follows that not finding them strong and faithful in that little in which he favoured them, by beginning to hew and polish them, like Michelangelo cutting away the bits to reveal David, or God is cutting away the little bits life is, that stop you being you. But we can't, we don't like the chisel. As a result, he proceeds no further in purifying them and raising them from the dust of the earth through the toil of mortification. They were in need of greater constancy and mortification than they showed. So we squirm and squeal under a little bit of suffering, and God gently holds back. He doesn't want to hurt us, and we're not willing to bear it. Still on this topic, some, a saying of John's was this, see if you like it. In tribulation, immediately draw near to God with confidence, and you'll receive strength, enlightenment, and instruction. Pretty good advice that he gives us. Another of his sayings, let Christ crucified be enough for you, and with him suffer and take your rest, and hence annihilate yourself in all inward and outward things. Have great love for trials, and think of them as but a small way of pleasing your spouse who did not hesitate to die for you. Another of his statements that may attract you is, love consists not in feeling great things, but in having great detachment and in suffering for the beloved. So the last little reflection on this presence in suffering on stanza 10 reads, it's John, it's a couple of letters that he wrote. It's right for us not to go without the cross, just as our beloved didn't go without it, even to his dying of love. He directs our sufferings in the love of what we most desire, that we might make greater sacrifices and be of greater value. But everything is brief. It lasts only till the knife is raised, remembering Abraham and Isaac. God doesn't want to hurt anyone. So he wants to love us through the trials that life brings. When something distasteful, says John, or unpleasant comes your way, remember Christ crucified and be silent. Live in faith and hope, even though you're in darkness, because it is in these times of darkness that God protects the soul. Cast your care upon God, for God watches over you and will not forget you. Do not think that God leaves you alone. That would be an affront to him. So it's a very faith presentation, of course. It doesn't make sense except to our faith, but there it is. Don't seek Christ, says John, without the cross. The last stanza I want to do with you now has a little bit of added interest because it didn't belong with the original canticle. John wrote it some years later and introduced it here when he rearranged his canticle with further reflection. So it's an added bit in. So he must have had a good reason to add it in, and this is how it reads. And it leads us to stanza 12, which I'll spend all tomorrow morning on, which is a key stanza. So it builds up to that. And it reads, "Reveal your presence, and may the vision of your beauty be my death. For the sickness of love is not cured except by your very presence and image." Reveal your presence, says the lover to the beloved who's hidden. May the vision of your beauty be my death. For the sickness of love is not cured except by your very presence and image. There's no other cure except communion. Well, he writes, John, truly, he quotes Zechariah, God is speaking to you, to me, truly, whoever touches you touches the apple of my eye. So you girls who thought your father, that you were the favourite of your father, hope you were, well, you actually happen to be the favourite of God. So that's not bad, is it? To think that you're the apple of God's eye. Of course you are. And then he quotes Isaiah. Before they call, I will answer. While they're still speaking, I will hear. God is never the problem. The heart of everything is evolving in this emerging universe, including you. So that's never the problem. It's our distraction from it and our busyness, etc. The many ways in which God is present, says John, and in typical scholastic fashion, he itemizes them. God is present by essence, that's his natural presence everywhere. By grace, that's his spiritual presence. And by intimate communion, which is the presence that this canticle is all about, which is the loving presence. Well, the many ways in which God is present are all of them hidden. For in them God does not reveal himself as he is, since the conditions of this life will not allow such a manifestation. No one has seen God, says John the Evangelist at the end of that beautiful prologue, but it's his only Son, the one who is nearest the Father's heart, who has made him known. You have said, I know you by name, and if you have found favour in my sight, Moses, in Exodus, John referring to it. If, says Moses, I found favour in your sight, show me your ways so that I may know you and find the grace which I desire fulfilled in your presence. And God says, you cannot see my face, for no one can see me and live. And the lover in the canticle is praying to die, to let everything go, so that she can see her beloved. May your beauty, the vision, be my death. Happy to let everything go to see. John of the Cross also reminds us of Paul, who wanted to be with Christ but wanted to stay too, whatever God wanted. He's willing to do either. But he wanted it, if he's going to stay, he wanted to be clothed over with the risen body. He wanted to be totally covered in or wrapped in the risen Christ. But if this is not to be, well, then he wants to leave the life and be with Christ. But either way, he wants to be with Christ in the mission now, which seems to him what God is calling him to, because people need what he's doing. But either way, he wants his whole body and heart to be wrapped in Christ. True love, says John of the Cross, receives everything that comes from the beloved, prosperity, adversity, chastisement, with the same evenness of soul, since they are his will, for they afford her joy and delight. A contemporary of John of the Cross, Ignatius of Loyola, when he talks about discernment, as you know, it's wonderful, really. The process of discernment, wanting to know God's will, really, is a process of getting, this is the hard bit, but getting to a state where we're equally ready to do this or to do that. Equally ready. Usually we're not there. We want to do one or other. Our emotions, our desires, whatever it is, we're not even. We're committed, we've got agenda and all that stuff. But the process of retreats, etc., is to bring us to a stage where we're happy to live or die, we're happy to go here or go there, we're happy to do this or stop doing it, we're happy to be healthy or sick, whatever. We're equally ready, waiting on God's will. Now, if we get to that stage, as Simone Weil, beautifully in her book Gravity and Grace, I think it is, tells us how we know God's will then. She says it's actually quite easy. If you're at that stage, then do what your heart wants. Follow your heart, because your heart is pure, it's ready. But you can only get to do that if you are actually, I'll read him again, true love receives everything that comes from the beloved with the same evenness of soul, since they are his will, for they afford her joy and delight. And to conclude this evening's offering, I'll read the stanza again and then a few little comments of John. Reveal your presence, says the lover. And all these first 12 stanzas are the pain of the hiddenness. Reveal your presence. May the vision of your beauty be my death. For the sickness of love is not cured except... It's not cured by the shepherds we saw. It's not cured by nature. It's not cured by anything at all. It can only be cured by your presence and your face, your image, your... Well, John writes, when she possesses some degree of love of God, no matter how little, she's alive, but very weak and infirm because of her little love. The bridegroom, he goes on to say, is the image into which she desires to be transformed through love. So this part, early part of the canticle, is all about where is your longing? What do you really want? How open is your heart to desire it, etc.? Like Mary of Magdala, are you willing to keep searching till he finds you? Feeble in love, says John, she's too weak to practice heroic virtue. She who feels this sickness, however, shows that she has some love. There's the longing there, and to long is to love.